From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Just how free are those so-called free-range chickens? On today's Fresh Air, Michael Pollan traces where the food in our fast food restaurants, supermarkets, and health food stores comes from. His new book is called The Omnivore's Dilemma. There's plenty of songs about Christmas and Hanukkah, not too many about Passover, which begins tomorrow evening. We'll ask Rob Tannenbaum and Sean Altman to introduce their Passover song, They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. Their band, What I Like About Jew, has been called the Simon and Garfunkel of ethnic gag songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's for dinner? And when you eat, will you have any idea where the food is really from and what's in it? My guest, Michael Pollan, has traced the history of four very different meals and in the process tells the larger story of industrial and organic food in America. One meal is fast food. One is from ingredients he bought at a natural foods supermarket. The third meal comes from an organic farm. The fourth is food that he hunted or gathered himself. Pollan is the author of the bestseller The Botany of Desire. He's a contributor to the New York Times Magazine and teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, is full of surprises. He traces a bushel of corn from a field in Iowa to its ultimate destination in a fast food meal. It turns out that about 13 of 38 ingredients in a chicken McNugget come from corn. Lots of our food industry is built around corn. Pollan calls it the plague of corn. Corn's a great food. What's the problem?
Well, corn itself is a great food, but we don't eat it as a food. We eat it as a kind of raw material in our food. What happens is we grow vast amounts of corn. It is the most important crop grown in this country. And then we, instead of just eating it off the cob, we feed it to animals, pass it through their digestion to turn it into protein, and we break it down into its constituent molecules. And then we reassemble it as high fructose corn syrup, as all the different chemical flavorings. So we're not really eating corn as a food. It's kind of a food substance. And that's very different.
So a lot of corn is used to make high fructose corn syrup, which is a sweetener. What are some of the many foods that are sweetened with that as opposed to with sugar?
Well, high fructose corn syrup turns up in all sorts of places you wouldn't expect to find it. And if you spend a little time at the supermarket, you will find it not just where you'd expect to, in the sports drinks and the sodas, but you'd find it in the breads. You find it in the relishes, in the mayonnaise, in the cookies, and all the different condiments. High fructose corn syrup is becoming, it's kind of infiltrating the entire supermarket. And the reason for that is, well, there are a couple reasons for it. It has other properties besides sweetening things. It ends up helping preserve things. It stabilizes food products so they last longer. It also creates that nice brown color on a roll or a hamburger bun. That comes from high fructose corn syrup. And, you know, we are hardwired to like sweetness. So if you can sneak sweetness into our ketchup, into our, into all these other products, you're going to sell more of them.
So you're saying it's like a covert way of sweetening foods, and therefore we eat more of them because we like the sweetness so much, and we don't even know that that's why we're eating more.
That's right. I mean, it's hidden in the foods, unless you read the labels, and it does work on us without us realizing it. We are suckers for sweetness, and we always have been. And, you know, it's one of the ways that processed food lies to our bodies, essentially. Because if you think about it in nature, the experience of sweetness is very rare. You know, you've got ripe fruit, and you've got certain vegetables, root vegetables get sweet, and you've got honey, and that's about it. But now that, thanks to all this cheap corn, the experience of sweetness is so cheap and available that if you're a food processor, you know, you would be stupid not to take advantage of it. So they put it in everything, and with the result, they were each eating 66 pounds of high fructose corn syrup every year.
And that's one of the reasons why you think that the corn-based agricultural economy is helping to make us obese.
Yes. I mean, it's not the only cause, but it is the prerequisite to have all those cheap calories around in such attractive forms. Cheap corn gives us supersizing. Cheap corn gives us an experience of sweetness that is so promiscuous in the supermarket that it's unavoidable.
You went to a really big corn farm. Would you just like describe what it looks like?
Yeah, I went to Chirdan, Iowa, and I found that in a way that's where all our fast food, all our supermarket food begins, in this farm field in Iowa. Iowa is really the state of corn. I mean, Iowa basically is owned by the corn plant. It is the most developed state in the country, which is a kind of a weird concept because we think of that as being, New York or California, but in fact, there's less pre-existing nature in Iowa than there is in New York or California. Iowa's where corn goes to party, essentially. I mean, this is, it has the run of the place. And I went to a very typical corn and bean farm. owned by a man named George Naylor, whose family has been farming there since the 1880s. And I use his farm to basically tell the story of modern industrial agriculture. And it's an interesting place. It feels like the middle of nowhere. It's a wide open black landscape. I was there in April or early May, and there is nothing growing at that point. The corn is just being planted, and the land is black. There are no fences anymore. They've all been taken down. As gradually these farms, which used to have 8, 10, 15 different crops and animals, used to have lots of fences, used to have parts that were green all year round, the pastures for the animals. Well, corn has essentially pushed everybody out, including the farmers. There are very few farmers left. The farmers are getting bigger, and one man or one woman can basically take care of 1,000 acres of cornfield in a couple days using high-tech equipment and pesticides and herbicides. And I spent a day in a tractor with George Naylor, and we planted a huge amount of corn. We must have planted 100 acres, 150 acres, sitting in a tractor the entire time, talking, getting acquainted. What was striking about this farm is how much food it produced. George was getting somewhere close to 200 bushels of corn off this land. Now, we hear the word bushel. It sounds like a lot. No one really knows what it is. Well, a bushel is 56 pounds of just the kernels, just to give you some idea. And if you can get 200 of those off an acre, you're growing 10,000 pounds of food. And what is striking about it is he's going broke doing it. He cannot make enough money to support the farm. The farm is essentially subsidized by his wife's job and, of course, a big check from the Department of Agriculture every year.
Now, why is it so hard to make a living on corn if we're using it in everything?
Well, because we grow so much of it. You know, I said he was growing about 200 bushels a year. His grandfather was growing about 20 bushels a year. As we've achieved these incredible increases in yield due to technology, by and large, and new hybrid seeds and everything, the price has crashed. A bushel of corn today in Iowa is selling for about $1.45. Remember, we're talking about 56 pounds of food. That is dirt cheap. That's a lot of anything to buy for $1.45. And basically what has happened is as the better American farmers get at producing, the lower the price of the commodities they're selling. The reason that corn has taken over the food supply is precisely because it is such a cheap raw ingredient. You know, 1980, when Coca-Cola started adding corn to its soda in the form of high fructose corn syrup, it's kind of a watershed moment. And the reason they did it was just so cheap. And that allowed them to take the, you know, that svelte 8-ounce Coke of my childhood and turn it into that chubby 20-ounce bottle that we see in every gas station today. So the fact that it's gotten cheaper has been wonderful for the people who process corn, for the Cargills and the ADMs and the Coca-Colas of the world. But it's been a disaster for the farmers because their price just keeps going down every year.
You mentioned the big corporations that process corn. You describe corn as the part of the food chain that allowed us or encouraged us to turn from the logic of biology and embrace the logic of industry when it comes to food production and processing. In what way?
Well, corn is in a way, it's the perfect industrial and perfect capitalist plant. I mean, if you think about it, first of all, it offers a wonderful form of intellectual property. Since with hybrid corn and now with GMO, genetically modified corn, the company that breeds it can really control it. The farmer cannot replant it every year. And that was a prerequisite to getting companies to invest a lot of money in corn because they could get their investment back. But it's also the proto-capitalist plant. I mean, it's just really thrived in the sunshine of capitalism because it lends itself to the way industrial capitalism works, which is to say it's a wonderful factory product. You put in huge quantities of fertilizer, pesticides, and you get out huge quantities of a raw material that you can turn into just about anything. You know, virtually anything that can be made from oil can be made from corn, and not to mention all the foodstuffs. So it allows a company to buy a cheap raw ingredient and add value, whether it's the convenience of a go-gurt or, you know, a ham or corn liquor. You know, a beer is made from a lot of corn ethanol. you start with this raw, cheap ingredient, and then you can build value. You can sell various services such as convenience or flavor or whatever, and then sell it back to us. So you take, you know, it in a soda, I mean, you're talking about a penny or two of this raw ingredient. It's actually something like 4 cents, I think. And you turn it into something you can sell for a dollar. It's a wonderful opportunity, basically, if you're making processed foods. But it actually dictates the making of processed foods, too, since we can't really eat it as food.
Where do Cargill and ADM fit in? They're two big agribusiness companies?
They are involved at every stage. And their names are not really that familiar to Americans, unless you, of course, listen to public radio and watch public television, because they don't really sell consumer products. What they do is they help the farmers grow it by selling them the inputs, the fertilizer and that kind of thing, and then they buy it from them at this network of grain elevators all across the Midwest, and then they feed it on feedlots to animals or turn it into high fructose corn syrup. And, you know, in following this bushel of corn through the whole system, I really wanted to go through every step of the way, and it would have been very useful, but as it turned out, impossible, to go to one of the places where they turn corn into high fructose corn syrup, which is one of the most important products. But ADM and Cargill would not let me in. And that's sort of, and that is that narrow sluice gate, basically, where the whole river of corn, that 10 billion bushel pile of golden kernels, passes through those companies, most of it. Or at least a large percentage of it, something like a third of it, actually. And they wouldn't let me near it. And that was kind of a shame. The reasons that they offered were biosecurity, which I thought was kind of interesting. They say that they're worried post 9/11 that with such a centralized food system, a terrorist with a vial of microbes could poison an awful lot of people if they could get into a facility like that. And they may well be right, or it's an excuse.
Or they're worried about bad press? Is that what you're suggesting?
Or they're worried about bad press. Uh-huh. I don't know. I mean, for me, getting access to the food system gets harder and harder the more I write about it. Mm-hmm. And especially if you've got companies that really aren't interested in consumers. They don't have consumer products. They really don't care, and they're happy to say no to journalists. You know, plus they've had a sort of checkered history. A lot of ADM executives have spent a lot of the last decade in jail. And involved in price-fixing scandals having to do with high-fructose corn syrup and lysine and other corn derivatives. So they're not that interested in having journalists there. But that's kind of where I couldn't follow the bushel the whole way. I had to pick it up on the other side of that network of tubes and tanks and enzymatic reactions by which they turn that corn into all these high-value-added ingredients.
My guest is Michael Pollan. His new book is called The Omnivore's Dilemma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Pollan, author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. When we left off, he was describing how much of our food industry is built around corn. Corn is cheap, but Pollan says there's lots of hidden expenses.
We have to talk just basically about basic biology. Most of what we eat is carbon. Most of that carbon started its life as carbon dioxide, atoms floating around in the air. Only plants can take that carbon and turn it through photosynthesis into a usable molecule of carbohydrate. That's how the system works. You know, all of life is a competition to get that carbon that only plants can give us. And we either eat the plants or we eat the plant eaters. And my image of corn was that it was basically participating in this process. But the more you look at it, you realize that even though that corn is waving beautifully under the bright sun in the summer, in fact, it is sipping fossil fuel. Because what allows you to grow corn in such quantity, that 200 bushels an acre, is a huge quantity of fossil fuel fertilizer. How we make all that fertilizer, it's a greedy plant. It takes an incredible amount of fertilizer. And that fertilizer is essentially made from petroleum, usually natural gas, but it can be made from oil. So in fact, every bushel of corn takes somewhere between a quarter and a third of a gallon of gasoline equivalent to grow. So as much as it might look like a solar-driven process, this corn-based food system is in fact a fossil fuel process. Corn is really the SUV of plants. And this whole system that is built upon it is adding, you know, adds more and more fossil fuel down the line to process the food, to create that high fructose corn syrup, lots of oil, to ship all that food, it's a national food system around, lots more oil. And you end up with a situation where about a fifth of our fossil fuel use is going to feed ourselves industrially. So it's another, you know, it's another problem with the corn-based food system. It's a very high-energy way to feed yourself.
So, you know, one of the things you do is trace what happens to this fossil fuel fertilizer after the plants are done with it, because there's still stuff that gets in the air and that runs through the earth and ends up going into rivers and streams and ponds and so on. So what are some of the side effects of this fossil fuel fertilizer?
Well, you know, all this cheap corn is incredibly expensive by several measures. One is, as we just talked about, energy, but also in terms of its environmental footprint, which is huge. All that fertilizer, and farmers use way too much of it. It's fairly cheap, and they consider it crop insurance. But a great deal of that fertilizer runs off the fields, ends up in the water. I mean, from the farm where I was at, it ends up in the it starts in the Beaver Creek and goes down to the Des Moines River. And women in Des Moines, young mothers, hear blue baby alerts in the spring. You can't use the water because Des Moines sips from the Des Moines River because there's so many nitrates in it that it will compromise your baby's ability to get oxygen to their brains. So they have to move to bottled water in the spring during the period of runoff. It then goes into the Mississippi, and it ends up going down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. And the Gulf of Mexico now has a dead zone. That's to say, kind of a Bermuda Triangle for fish. They go into it and they die. That is the size of New Jersey. That is cheap corn's waste product. It's its septic system, essentially. So that's part of the cost that doesn't show up in your 99-cent hamburger or your $1.20-ounce Coke. Wendell Berry once said the motto of our industrial food system should be cheap at any price.
So do you try to stay away personally from the foods that have the high fructose corn syrup in it?
I do. I don't think high fructose corn syrup is an evil substance, but I think it's a marker for food that is way too processed. I mean, if you think about it, you know, what chef uses high fructose corn syrup? What cook uses high fructose corn syrup? It's a marker of a food product rather than a food. So if you avoid high fructose corn syrup, it's a pretty good shorthand to avoid highly processed food. And I do try to avoid that. I think that eating that kind of food simply doesn't give us what we need. And to my mind, you know, having seen those farms and having seen that fertilizer runoff, I don't find it that appetizing anymore.
So do you think corn is kind of controlling the way we farm in America? In other words, are these kinds of big industrial corn farms driving out other kinds of agriculture?
Absolutely. What the corn did was essentially to, you know, I don't mean to, corn is sort of the hero of one-third of this book, and I do see it as an actor driving its own story to a certain extent. But it, for example, these farms, such as the farm I was on, used to have animals on them. And the farmers, which was in retrospect a wonderful system, because you had crops here and then you had animals here. The animals would eat your crop waste, all the corn stalks and extra stuff that you produced. And their manure would give you your source of fertility. So you had this kind of closed nutrient loop on all these farms all over the Midwest. And what we have done instead is, again, to quote Wendell Berry, is taken a solution and neatly divided it into two problems, which is to say, we have this enormous pollution problem in the way we grow animals now because we've moved them off the farms and into feedlots. And we have an enormous fertility problem on the farms because we don't have any animals to provide fertility. So we have to buy all this fossil fuel fertilizer. Now, why did the animals leave the farm? Well, in this sense, corn pushed them out. Since you can buy that bushel of corn so cheaply on the market, $1.45 now, it costs a farmer about $2.50 to grow that bushel of corn. So he cannot grow it as cheaply as the feedlot can buy it. So therefore, it's not economical for him to keep animals on his farm. And the animals get driven off, and they end up in these vast cities that float on the sea of, you know, oil-fed corn. And that's how we get our meat now, on these vast feedlots. So essentially what's happened is corn has sort of urbanized the landscape of the Middle West. I mean, to nature, having one kind of species, essentially corn and soybeans too, is as dull a place as had it been paved over. There are no birds in Iowa. There's no biodiversity in Iowa. It is as urban a landscape as you can imagine. It just happens to be green with these plants. So corn has simplified everything. It's simplified our diet. It's simplified our landscape. And I know I must sound a little bit like a monomaniac on the subject of corn, and this is not the corn theory of all history, but it is a chunk of history, a very important chunk of history, that we are living and are completely oblivious to.
Michael Pollan is the author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Understanding the Critical Link Between Mothers, Daughters, and Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start May 1st at capella.edu. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, do the organic chickens and cows really lead the pastoral lives described on the labels in organic supermarkets? We continue our conversation with writer Michael Pollan. Also, a Passover song from the satirical band What I Like About Jew. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Pollan. In his new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, he traces the history of four meals, and in the process, tells the larger story of the American food industry, including fast food and organic food. Now, one of the things you do is go to, you walk through Whole Foods. You walk through a big, like organic supermarket that's a chain, and you talk about what you describe as storied food, the kind of food that comes with a story on it. Give us some examples of what you mean.
Well, I have a real weakness for Whole Foods. I think that they are some of the most brilliant storytellers in America right now. And as you walk through that store, in fact, I just came from a Whole Foods where I had some lunch, And as you walk through a Whole Foods, you see all these wonderful pastoral tales. You know, the milk that came from cows that lived according to their natural predilections with the company of their own kind, or the chickens that were ranging free, or one of my favorite, the cage-free eggs. You know, I didn't really know that eggs really thought much about whether they were in cages or not, but apparently they like being cage-free too. And these images of farmers, you know, that are up in my Whole Foods in California where I live, the walls are covered with these pictures of small farmers, the pioneers of the organic movement. And you have this kind of very seductive, wonderful pastoral experience. It's like reading Virgil in the supermarket right now. And they're very clever about it. And I think their success, which has been astounding, I mean, they are the most successful supermarket chain in America in terms of their growth, suggests that we're searching for an alternative to industrial food, suggests that we are very concerned about our food. You know, we're very anxious about what we're eating and confused about it. And we're looking for a set of answers. We're looking for food, I think, to reconnect us to the natural world, which is, of course, what it always did and still does. I mean, even the Twinkie, you know, starts out in that farm field somewhere. I don't know what it comes from, but it comes from some plant. And so we're very desirous of returning food to some kind of meaningful relationship, a connection between our bodies and nature. Because eating is our most profound engagement with the natural world. We forget that. But I think there's a collective act of remembering, and Whole Foods is part of that. And they're offering one set of answers. As it turns out, though, you know, they're wonderful storytellers, but if you read between the lines and you actually kind of follow that food back to the earth, as I did, the results can be a little disappointing.
You know, a lot of people are trying to eat eggs from free-range chickens and, you know, chicken meat that's from free-range chickens. So you went to a farm where the chickens are supposed to be free-range chickens. What were you expecting, and compare that to what you found?
Well, I don't want to disillusion you, Terry, but the life of a free-range chicken is not quite all it's cracked up to be, or the image that you would have looking at the package in Whole Foods. I went to a place near me in California where that grows organic free-range chickens, and what I found was essentially an organic factory farm. Chickens grown in tremendous sheds about the length of a football field in a series set up like barracks marching down the landscape. There are 20,000 of them in one of these sheds, and they're getting organic grain, and they're not eating meat byproducts, which arguably is not such a good thing because chickens are omnivores. They do eat protein. They do eat meat protein. They live indoors, except after 5 weeks, a little door at either end of this giant shed is opened, and it opens onto a narrow strip of lawn. And you have to imagine sort of the front lawn on your house. And there is a little ramp down through that door, and the chickens, at their option, could walk down that ramp into that lawn and range free. Well, when I was there, they didn't. And I was kind of curious as to why that was, and I asked the people in charge, and they said, well, you know, the door's been closed for 5 weeks of their lives, and by the way, what you need to know is they die at 7 weeks. So we're not talking about a lifestyle. We're talking about a two-week vacation option, essentially, for these chickens. But the whole flock is indoors. The food is indoors. Why would they go outside? They've never been outside. They don't know any, you know, it's like that Manhattan cat who imagines on the other side of the door, it's never been outside, is an alternative universe. They're terrified to go outside. And you know what? That suits the farmers, so-called, quite well, because they're terrified, since these animals are raised without antibiotics, that they'll catch their death of cold out there. And they might well. I mean, one of the ironies about practicing organic agriculture on an industrial scale is that it is incredibly precarious because you're not giving those chickens antibiotics. So, and they still are living in close confinement, you know, a tremendous monoculture, one essentially set of genes that they could very easily be wiped out by a single microbe. So you just assume they didn't go outside and you essentially have organized things so they don't.
You went to one chicken farm that you thought really did treat the chickens well. Would you describe what was good about it?
Yeah, you know, there's organic and there's organic, and or beyond organic, as some farmers like to say. And, you know, I did find farms that I felt wonderful about eating from. And I went to one in particular. This is Joel Salatin's farm in Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. And he's doing not just, he's doing chickens both for eggs and for meat, and he's doing grass-fed beef and turkeys and rabbits and pigs. And he is showing, and I think this is perhaps one of the most sustainable farms in America, that there is a way that you can grow animals in a way that is, they get to sort of live according to their creaturely character and end up producing very high quality meat. The way he does it is every day he moves the cows to one pasture to another pasture. So they get to graze one day, let the pasture recover, move on. And then he brings in, after 3 days, his eggmobile, which is a portable chicken house, essentially. And those chickens fan out over the that grass. They eat some grass, and they also eat the grubs out of the cow patties, which is their favorite food because they're evolved to eat insects and larvae. They perform several functions. And it's a very kind of, it's interesting because it's a different concept of efficiency. Then it's not an industrial concept of efficiency. It's an ecological idea of efficiency. And essentially what happens is the chickens perform several services for the cattle or vice versa. And so the chickens are eating the grubs, which is to say the fly larvae that would bother the cows if they were allowed to hatch. They're also spreading the manure by digging through it, and they're fertilizing the pasture. They're laying down all this nitrogen in their manure. And then they move out, and you wait another couple weeks, and then you bring the cattle back in. And the result of this kind of very elaborate rotation, and it's basically modeled on what happens in nature, because if you think about it, birds follow herbivores in nature. They always have. They clean up after them. The result of this is land that is actually improved at the end of the year. And for me, this was perhaps the most heartening thing I saw in my entire kind of investigation of the food system.
My guest is Michael Pollan. His new book is called The Omnivore's Dilemma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Pollan, and he's the author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. You know, people are so into mocking people who buy only organic foods. It's like, oh, you can only eat boutique food. Oh, you're so spoiled that you only can eat things that are certified organic and that are really expensive. Doesn't that make you very privileged? What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think there really is an issue. I mean, look. To eat well in this country, which is to say to eat in a way that is healthy for you and healthy for the environment and doesn't use a lot of energy, is more expensive. So that's an issue we have to grapple with. A lot of this food is elitist food and can be called elitist food and often is, usually by the way, proponents of the industrial food system. You know, any situation where McDonald's is claiming the high moral ground, I'm a little dubious of, and this is one of them. But I think we have to confront this. And, you know, there's several different ways to look at it. One is cheap food is not as cheap as it looks. The real cost of that 99-cent burger in terms of is charged to the public health, is charged to the environment, is charged to your health. So even though it's cheap at the register, that is not the real cost of that food. That is an irresponsible price. And I don't know that people want to buy irresponsibly. Now, some people don't have a choice. And there are a percentage of people in this country who probably can't afford to eat organic or even eat more sustainably. Because organic is not the only answer. Let's not oppose organic to everything else. There are many other alternatives out there. Grass-fed beef is not organic, but it's better, I think, than organic beef. If you go to the supermarket, it is true that and you're a rational actor and you don't have a lot of money, if you're basically buying energy for your family, that's to say calories, the rational thing for you to do under the system we have is to patronize the center of the store, all the processed food. Because a dollar will get you 2,500 calories of cookies, of snacks, of potato chips. And if you go to the produce aisle, it will only get you 250 calories of carrots. So, you know, we're programmed by evolution to seek the most energy with the least effort possible. And the supermarket has created an environment where that forces people, essentially, to buy the least healthy calories. But that's not a function of the free market. That's not a function of nature either. That is a function of policy. There's a reason that the least healthy calories in the supermarket are the cheapest, and that is essentially policy. We subsidize the cheap calories. We subsidize those calories. Those are the calories that come from corn. And all those calories, all that high fructose corn syrup is subsidized by our taxpayer dollars. The carrots are not. So it seems to me for the people who are shopping this way, the challenge is to change the set of incentives and figure out a way to make the healthy food cheaper and the unhealthy food a little bit more expensive.
You know, to compound the problems that you're writing about and kind of what's gone wrong with the food industry is global now. So in addition to all the fossil fuel that's being used for fertilizer, it takes so much fuel to drive around all the produce and the meat from the place that it's grown and produced to the place where it's actually purchased and eaten. So that's another problem you talk about in your book.
And that's a problem with organics as well. And, I that's a big problem with Whole Food. I was just in the Whole Food in Union Square in New York, where there's an interesting kind of drama taking place because you have one of the best farmers markets in the city going head-to-head with Whole Foods. And there in that Whole Food was grass-finished beef, wonderful, environmentally sustainable product. But guess where it was coming from? New Zealand. Directly across the street in the farmer's market in Union Square were two people selling grass-finished beef from the Hudson Valley, from 90 miles away. Why are we going to New Zealand to get that beef? That long industrial organic food chain ends up consuming just as much energy as the rest of the food chain. And that's why I think, really, local food is the really important movement going on in food right now.
And do you try to eat local food?
I try to eat local food whenever I can. And because local food, you know, if our food dollars are votes, local food supports a lot more values, I think, than organic food. Organic food supports a certain level of care of the environment, no pesticides. Local food supports controlling sprawl, keeping farmers in my community, a kind of landscape. When we think of the New England landscape that we love, what is that? You know, that those forests and fields bisected by those stone fences. Well, that's a landscape created by farmers and their animals and the people who ate those animals. It will not survive without people still eating from that landscape. So in a way, buying local is a vote for land conservation as well, and probably a lot more useful and sustainable than writing checks to environmental organizations.
Your book ends with you eating a meal that completely comes from ingredients from foods that you from animals that you hunted and foods that you foraged. And why did you want to do that?
To see if I could. I was very curious I looked at the longest food chain. I wanted to look at the shortest. And, of course, the shortest food chain is the hunted, gathered, and grown food chain. And I had done a fair amount of gardening in the past. I had never hunted. I had never foraged for mushrooms. And I really wanted to get back to the basics. And, this isn't a practical solution. I don't offer this as something anybody else should do. But as a ritual matter, as a way to, you know, for once in my life, and I don't know that I'll ever do it again, to really understand how my eating connects me to the natural world. When I killed a boar as part of this process in Northern California, and when I watched that boar hanging from the tree and we were cleaning it, which was a really difficult and disgusting process that, you know, made me really think about eating meat and how I felt about it and really confront the difficulties of it. But there I could see an entire food chain. You know, the sun was feeding these oak trees, the acorns were feeding this pig, and this pig was going to feed me. And there was something quite beautiful about that, as well as being disgusting. And I felt I understood something important that we forget, which is to say that, you know, we eat by the grace of nature, not industry. And we forget that. And every time we eat, we're engaging with the natural world. And all of our eating decisions are supporting one set of species or another, one kind of landscape or another. And, you know, we can't live in full consciousness of that all the time. But to live in greater consciousness of it than we do is the first step toward changing our relationship to nature. I don't think you can call yourself an environmentalist if you're thoughtless about your eating. It's too important a relationship to the rest of the world. So for me, it was a ceremony as much as anything. It was like my bar mitzvah. It was a kind of, and like my bar mitzvah, I don't have to do it again. But it was a kind of coming of age in my own eating. And I eat a lot more carefully. I eat meat. I don't waste meat. There's a story told about Thomas Keller, who, you know, some people think is the greatest chef in America today, at the French Laundry in Per Se in New York, once deciding he should kill a rabbit to see what it was all about. And it was really hard, and he couldn't grab the rabbit, and he broke its leg accidentally, and it was a messy killing, and he felt terrible about it. But he resolved at that point to make the best rabbit dish anyone had ever had, that he was going to treat that rabbit with reverence and kind of redeem the sloppiness of the act. You know, that's conscious eating and conscious cooking. And that's the beginning of taking better care of the animals we've co-evolved with and of the land that we depend on.
Well, Michael Pollan, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Michael Pollan is the author of the new book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's a professor in the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, a Passover song by a satirical band called What I Like About You. This is Fresh Air. My guests, Sean Altman and Rob Tannenbaum, are the founders of the satirical band What I Like About You. In the Boston Globe, their songs were described as racy and funny and smart and affectionate, written for a generation of fully assimilated Jews who grew up on punk rock and South Park. Tannenbaum is the music editor of Blender magazine. Altman is a performer with Kol Zimra and Voices for Israel. Their new CD, Unorthodox, features a song about Passover. It's called They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew. Moses was found on the Potomac. Then he marched with Martin Luther King. He came back to free us from our bondage, 'cause S&M has never been our thing. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat.
They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So they chase us to the border, there's a parting of the water. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat!
Then the Pharaoh, who looked like Yul Brynner, heard the Jews were trying to escape. Charlton Heston came right down from the mountain. He said, Pharaoh, you're a damn dirty ape. The menorah was almost out of oil. Farrakhan was planning Kristallnacht. The gefilte fish was nearing extinction. It looked looked like Moses and his flock were fucked. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. And we knew how to resist, cause we'd rented Schindler's List. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. The 10 Egyptian plague.
That's the band What I Like About Jew from their new CD, Unorthodox. Sean Altman, Rob Tannenbaum, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your Passover song is called They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. Does the title of this song sum up what a Seder used to be like when you were growing up?
In fact, it sums up pretty much every Jewish holiday, Terry. But we were comforted by the fact that every Jewish holiday can be summarized with the phrase, They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat.
And you know, Sean and I both grew up in very Reform households. In my family, Passover Seder was pretty much a sprint to the finish. It was how quickly can we get through the four questions? What if we read only two of the four questions? What if we went from the back of the prayer book, because you know Jews read from back to front. What if we went from one end of the Seder book to the other in about 6 minutes? And it never seemed really to make God angry. So year after year, we just made the Seder shorter and shorter. It was speed reading.
Also, you know, the Seder is the first time that most Jewish children get to drink alcohol. And so some of my fondest memories are chugging that deliriously sweet kosher wine called Manischewitz.
I always thought that Manischewitz wine was adults' attempt to convince children that there was no pleasure to be had in wine.
Manischewitz is Ripple for Jews. Basically, we drink like bums at Passover. It does seem to be part of a specific Jewish tradition of not experiencing or not associating any real joy with your religion.
You know, I'm thinking holidays like Hanukkah and Christmas have so much song. They're like song holidays. I can't think of any songs that I know about Passover except for yours.
Well, there is an old Hebrew song that the Jews sing at Passover. But, I mean, let's face it, it's in Hebrew. How far is that going to go?
Yeah, it's a song about one little goat. I mean, you can't compare Irving Berlin, Jew, by the way. You can't compare songs like White Christmas or Easter Parade with a song about a little goat.
So do you have Passover gigs coming up? Are there such things as Passover gigs?
We have a whole slew of Passover gigs. In fact, Rob and I are about to embark on our first tour of the West Coast.
We're referring to this as our Exodus tour because it's a chance for us to get the hell out of New York.
So, are you going to eat matzah on Passover?
If you'll
sure.
remind us when Passover is, yes.
You know, then matzah with a nice big shrimp on top of it tastes really delicious.
Matzah is another one of those unfortunate lessons for Jews, like the bar mitzvah. You know, how are we going to celebrate the holiday? We're going to eat flat, dry crackers. I remember when I was a kid at Passover, my mother would pack me a lunch of matzah and cream cheese. You know, that sounds pretty good, but my mom didn't like to get up in the morning, so she would pack it the night before and stick it in the refrigerator. And basically, by noon the next day, it would be sort of like glue between a couple of thin twigs. And you know, I would go to school and everybody else would be taking out their ham and cheese sandwiches on French baguettes. And I would be eating, you know, a paste sandwich and think, God, life is so much better when you're a Christian.
It's, you know, a Jew's relationship with Jewish food is interesting because I actually enjoy all of the so-called grotesque Jewish foods. Most of them start with the word K, like kishka, kasha, kugel, knedel,
kreplach.
Most of them are derived from Eastern European foods, where typically, you know, Jews couldn't afford to eat the good stuff. So this was the stuff that like the wealthier people threw away. You know, the intestines, the feet, the you know weird internal organ things that nobody else wanted to eat, which Jews have made into delicacies.
Gefilte fish is just like the slime that sunk to the bottom of the ocean that nobody with any kind of money wanted to eat, but somehow was turned into a delicacy in the Jewish ghettos.
I want to thank you both for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Let's eat.
The 10 Egyptian plagues.
1.
Blood.
2.
Locusts.
3.
Boils.
4.
Dandruff.
5.
Acne.
6.
Bacne.
7.
Piles.
8.
Cataracts.
9.
Sciatica.
10.
Sickle cell anemia.
We fled on foot. There was no time to tarry. Leavening the bread would take too long. All we had was egg foo young and matzah, while battling the fearsome Viet Cong. And so tonight we gather to remember the ancient Hebrews who paid the price. We have a Seder each year in December to commemorate our Savior Jesus Christ. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So we never did succumb to the annual pogrom. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we survived.
Rob Tannenbaum and Shorn Altman are the founders of the satirical band What I Like About Jew. Their new CD is called Unorthodox. You can find out more about the band on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art and its current exhibition of paintings by Edvard Munch. MOMA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter and former Cairo bureau chief Neil McFarquhar. He's written a satirical novel about the press corps during the Gulf War. Also, director Mary Harron talks about her new movie, The Notorious Betty Page, starring Gretchen Mol as the famous 1950s pinup. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.